Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
It's weird there isn't a movie about the Ute leader Wakara, who roamed the territory that's now central Utah in the mid-1800s, because he was the perfect character. He was brilliant and ferocious, kind of crafty. Wakara, also known as Wakara or Chief Walker, came from the Timpanogos band of the Ute people. But his influence stretched through the trade routes and the tracks of the larger American West. He patrolled the old Spanish trail, and he stole thousands of horses that he sold in markets as far away as New Mexico. He was a ruthless trader of enslaved natives. He captured Paiutes, mostly women and children. He strong-armed caravans of covered wagons. But the historian Max Perry Mueller says in his new biography that Wakara also created maps of the mountain passes and the river crossings of the region. In fact, he helped shape the boundaries of the Southwest, including the first Mormon settlement in the Salt Lake Valley. Mueller says as the Mormon pioneers were making their way west in 1847, they weren't really clear about their destination.
And they're imagining possibilities of where they'll end up. One possibility is Texas. Another possibility is California. But really, they had their hearts set on the Great Basin, what is now central Utah. Pushed west by persecution, but pulled west by the opportunity to missionize native peoples. And one of the things they've heard is this rich, verdant area around what is today Utah Lake. It has tremendous grassland, rich fisheries, and timber to make their settlements. And their hearts are set on locating the new Zion in what becomes central Utah. But one of the reasons they know anything about Utah Lake is because of Wakara. John C. Fremont met Wakara as he was mapping the Great Basin in 1843. And Wakara told him all about it. And John C. Fremont wrote in his journals, jotted on his maps, and they became the maps that the Latter-day Saints would use to pilot themselves to the Great Basin. So, you know, this wasn't some empty space. It was a homeland to Wakara's Timpanogos Utes. And Wakara and his kin had a firm grip on what is today Utah Lake. So the Vanguard Company, Brigham Young's famed company of about 100 pioneers, make their way across Nebraska and into southern Wyoming, and they meet at Jim Bridger, the famed mountain man and explorer, at his outpost there. And they get more information and resupply. And Jim Bridger, they tell him that, hey, we're going to head down to Utah Lake, what most likely was called then Timpanogos Lake. And Jim Bridger warns Brigham, hey, if you go down there, Wakara's Timpanogos will run you out. You're a small ragtag bunch of 100 or so people. Down there, there are thousands of well-armed Timpanogos warriors. So if you head down there, they'll run you out, or worse. And so Brigham Young changed his mind, and he decided he'd locate the center stake of Zion around the Great Salt Lake. So I always kind of half jokingly, tongue in cheek, say, you know, it wasn't Heavenly Father who told Brigham this is the place, but Wakara and his Utes who decided where the center stake of Zion would be located. This story matters for two central reasons. It underlines the fact that Wakara really did help create the American West as we know it. But we don't remember that story. We don't teach that story as part of the mythology. And why don't we teach it? Because the key part of Manifest Destiny, and I would argue the most dangerous myth of Manifest Destiny, is that it succeeded. It succeeded in erasing Native peoples from America, and in particular, the American West. And by remembering Waqara's influence on the creation of the Mormon homeland, we help to restore the important place that Native people played in the creation of the American West and America writ large. We recognize that they are still here today. There are lots of Native citizens still very much present in our politics and our cultures today.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Max Perry Mueller's new biography is called Waqara's America, and he's joining us today to talk about it. So if this Ute leader, this complicated man, was one of the most influential forces in the colonization of the West, a case that Mueller makes in his book, why is it that Waqara is largely absent from the founding stories of the place? That's where we began.
The origin of America is, in a lot of ways, Manifest Destiny. As I say, the first article of faith of the American gospel, in which the purpose and destiny of America, as it expands westwardly, is the erasure of Native people and Native presence and people on the land. It's a purposeful erasure. And then, though, and of course, this is not true. Native people are still here today. If you go to Indian country, you know, and that could be anywhere, reservations, cities, we are still here is perhaps the most popular refrain of Native people, especially when they're talking to white settler descendants like myself. But then you bump into constantly, of course, along the way, Native people and helping to create what becomes America. And that is particularly true, I think, when we get to a figure like Waqara in the Great Basin, in what becomes Utah. But for us to tell that story, the story of Manifest Destiny as erasure of Native people and presence on the land, we had to forget Waqara and his contribution to what becomes the American West. He had to be removed, as I say, not only from the land, but from the history books for us to tell that story.
Explain why, because this is how you put it in the book. His humanity has been forgotten, and it was forgotten on purpose.
Yeah. So, you know, some people know about Waqara. He pops up, you know, even in public school curriculum here and there. But he serves a purpose, like a lot of Native figures do in that origin story. And I describe it as the paper Indian. Yeah. Settlers write down on paper descriptions of Native peoples that serve their purposes rhetorically, politically, religiously. And then they fold that paper Indian kind of, I think of it into kind of a puppet in some ways. And then they get that puppet to talk or an act. This isn't the real Indian. This is a paper Indian. This isn't what actually happened. And so forgetting his humanity, as you, I'm glad you pointed it out, means he can't be a full 3D, even four-dimensional person, right? Who acts in his own self-interests, acts in what we often would think of today as admirable ways of defending himself, of defending his people, of defending his land, his resources, and less than admirable ways when he's manipulating people, using, for example, settlers to root out his rivals, remove his rivals.
Enslaving other human beings?
Yes, absolutely. Enslaving, especially his Numic language kin, the Paiutes, and trading them away to amass his own power, to spread what I call his empire of flesh. So yes, he's a human figure.
Which just tells us that he was, what you're getting at, a deeply complicated man, like a lot of men from the history of the West.
Absolutely. A deeply complicated man like his sometimes rival, sometimes partner, Brigham Young, who he did a lot of admirable things and he did And towards those goals of doing admirable things, he did a lot of things that we look back on with some judgment, understandably.
What do you think when he does appear, and as you say, occasionally in some school books and some impressions and some sort of vague ideas of the past, he sort of shows up, but he seems to be a kind of caricature. What's the image that he... I mean, we'll get to the real person, but what's the kind of knee-jerk image or myth, do you think, of Ouattara?
He was a really important figure. If you look at the newspaper reports of his era, both from California, from Utah, I mean, he's everywhere, showing up everywhere. He was an active player in the drama of the creation of American West that a lot of people read about. The readers, whether it's in Vermont, South Carolina, or California, knew Ouattara of the 1840s and 1850s. But even during that period, the Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, are creating this image of Ouattara that changes over time. But so sometimes he is the archetypal Indian antagonist. And I'm going to use a word that is, I want to be very careful here, but it's the word that shows up often, which is a savage person. Right. Savage Indian, actually, detached from the person, is the savage Indian. And Indian and savage become one and the same, who, by his bloodlust, attacks innocent settlers who just are trying to live their lives, plant their crops, move their horses, raise their families, etc. Over time, though, he becomes a noble figure, a figure whose greatness, in fact, grows almost literally. Ouattara, the actual, we know an amazing piece of documentation, Brigham Young's secretary and clerk actually measured the Utes in 1851, measured their heights and weights. So Ouattara was about 5'7 and I think 165 pounds, which is a pretty good height, but and fairly stout for his age. But he figuratively grows in the kind of lore literature of the West, when he's written about, is portrayed in by the 1920s as 6'6", grows a whole foot. And I think that's kind of emblematic because his height, his greatness, his ferocity as a slave trader, his proficiency as a horse thief, and his body, again, grow so that he becomes such a figure of nobility in some ways that when the settlers eventually best him, the implied message is that that even furthers their greatness, the settlers' greatness, their triumph, because they bested such a great, noble figure. That is a little bit of Ouattara. And I think that's a lot of how he's remembered today. There are a few number of books that tell Ouattara's story as kind of historical fiction, not the actual person. He does seem like this noble figure who, in romanticizing the past, kind of white settlers like to pretend to be today. But they're able to do that because, you know, he's gone, is the idea. And so they can play Indian, as the great Phil DeLoria has written. They can play Indian because Indians are no longer here. So they can cosplay. So the danger is gone.
Let's talk about his early life. Was Ouattara destined to be a Ute leader? His father and some of his older male relatives, they were leaders. Was he pegged as being one as well? And how was he thought of, if we know, in those early days? I mean, he came to have such enterprising skill and his gifts with language and horsemanship, and he was an incredible hunter. And as you said, he defined boundaries and map. But did he seem that way from the beginning?
You know, it's hard to tell his origin stories. We have a couple of moments where he describes his origins. The story that Ouattara tells is this. He was born into the leading family of the Timpanogos Utes. The center of their world was and is Utah Lake. They called it Timpanogos Lake, where they gathered every year to fish, especially during the spawning seasons of late spring and early summer. And then that was their homeland. But Ouattara's family, it seems like, according to what he said, had a fight over how they would relate to other tribes, especially the Shoshones to their north. And so Wakara's father led, according to Wakara, led a group of Timpanogos Utes to separate from the main band at Utah Lake and went down towards what is now Spanish Fork, because that group, Wakara's father, he says, didn't want to fight the Shoshones. Anyway, so a succession crisis and dispute over relations caused a schism. Wakara says that his Timpanogos kin did not take kindly to that split and shot his father in the back while he was smoking a peace pipe. And that is a, you know, an unforgivable sin, right? And so that led to a tension between Wakara's group, his own splinter band, and the main set of lodges at Utah Lake. So I wouldn't necessarily say he was destined. In some ways, circumstance, like a lot of people, circumstances change one's path. He might have been just a member of the kind of ruling community there in Timpanogos Lake, were it not for this schism. But yes, that forced him in some ways to find other sources of food, power, and so that sent him on this alternative path, exploring, following other fur trappers, other more entrepreneurial Utes who started horse raiding in the 1830s, traveling along the old Spanish trail, and stealing horses by the thousands.
You mention in the book that he became a living legend in the American West for a time. Mm-hmm. Newspapers, best-selling books. So it sounds like he was feared. And I wonder, did people have a right to be afraid of him? I mean, he manipulated people into his services, as you say. He wanted them to pay to, you know, go to certain places. How much of that did he back up with, you know, menace and violence?
Yeah, so I'll go back to the encounter he had with John C. Fremont, who met him as Wakara was, as John C. Fremont says, in May 1843, I believe. As John C. Fremont is moving north in what is central Utah, as he plans on mapping the Great Salt Lake and the Utah Valley, and he meets Wakara and his cavalry. And John C. Fremont describes Wakara. He's cut from a better fashion than the rest of the natives he's encountered. He's really well armed, as is his cavalry. But then John C. Fremont, in his journals, which become bestsellers, Fremont describes how Wakara and he entered into an exchange of blankets. And Wakara convinced him to give up a less high quality blanket from New Mexico for a blanket of greater quality, most likely from the Northwest, most likely a Hudson Bay blanket. So they had to trade these unequal blankets, which was a toll for crossing the lands, others described it. But yes, other times, you know, when he's horse raiding in California, and Wakara by then was known as the greatest horse thief, the California.
Yeah, well, explain that. When you say horse raiding, I'm guessing most people kind of know what that means. But basically, what that means is he's going around stealing hundreds, maybe thousands of horses, basically. Yeah.
Yeah. So there was a whole season of horse raiding. And Wakara wasn't the only one, but he was definitely the most prolific and feared. Every fall, he starts out and goes along the old Spanish trail, you know, leaving his homeland around Timpanogos Lake, Utah Lake, heading south across Paiute territory, and then crossing Nevada into California. And then he'd spend a couple of months. And every few weeks, he'd go and raid these large ranchos, stealing horses from their paddocks, often at nighttime, and coordinated attacks, and then running the horses up past the canyons he knew very well, around Cajun Pass and into what is now known as Horse Thief Canyon and other places. And the Walker was his anglicized name, the Walker Trail up there, named after him. And so,
man, he covered a lot of ground, didn't
he? Thousands and thousands of miles, most likely each year. And So in 1845, he arrives at one of these ranchos, and he presents himself in kind of ironic. They knew he was coming. The word had spread through the Californios that Wacara is coming. They called him Wack, W-A-K. Wack is coming, and he's feared, and they were going to raise up posses to defend the horses and their territory. But he marches in. He doesn't present himself as this great feared head of a cavalry. He comes with a bunch of families and say, hey, I'm not here to steal from you. I'm here to trade. Look, here's my family, and here are a couple of slaves, most likely Paiutes he enslaved along the way for trade. I'm not here to steal your horses. And I describe this as kind of, you know, maybe too much of a pun, but a Trojan horse. He was a Trojan horse here. And soon after, he raided likely hundreds, perhaps as many as 1,000 horses that season. And that bulk was really important because not all the horses survived that arduous trek back. Only the healthiest horses survived that arduous trek back. A lot of them died along the way. Some describe the bones of the horses along the old Spanish trail as serving as cairns, right? Trail markers to mark the old Spanish trail so that other settlers could follow. And yeah, but the horses are still here too. Those horses are still here.
Yeah.
And that is a key part of the book is how this history is, yes, of the past, but continues in the present.
Max Perry Mueller is an associate professor in the Department of Classics and Religious Studies at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. His book is Wacara's America, The Life and Legacy of a Native Founder of the American West. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the historian Max Perry Mueller about his epic new biography of Wacara. Mueller says the Ute leader became a living legend of the American West. Newspapers and books told the stories of his horse-thieving raids. He was feared and respected. He was crafty and charismatic. He fought and negotiated with the Mormon settlers. He even agreed to be baptized. But he was a fierce protector of his people's authority over their own lives and land, and he helped shape the boundaries of the American Southwest and the settlement of the Utah Territory. The book is called Wacara's America. I want to ask about one of the themes in the book, which is how Wacara is this, as you describe him sort of as this key partner with settlers and, you know, pioneers, but also an opponent. There's that sort of dual role that he plays. When does he, we'll get to Brigham Young here in a minute, but when does he first encounter Mormon pioneers or Mormon settlers or scouts? When does he first encounter that particular band of white people?
Yeah. We don't have written evidence that the first time we have evidence that he's encountering the Latter-day Saints is in 1848, when he has a few meetings with the folks who begin exploring Utah Valley. But I can only imagine that he knew that the Latter-day Saints were there as soon as they got there on July 24th, 1847. I'm pretty darn sure that while the settlers are building the old fort and laying the key parts of what is now Temple Square, Wacara was watching. And on that buffalo trail north that he and his people knew so well, he was watching them. These ragtag, trail-worn settlers. So I imagine them, he's saying, hey, you know, they look pretty industrious. What they're building is unimpressive. I can imagine the old Bowery, the first Bowery built in Temple Square, did not impress him with its rough-hewn timbers and thatch roof, nothing like his beautiful tents and lodges. So he wasn't impressed, but they seemed industrious enough. And man, maybe I can use them to expand my network of trading nodes. and perhaps I can sell them enslaved people and horses. In other words, how can I fold these settlers who seem to present not much of a threat because he had bested so many other settlers beforehand, better settlers beforehand. He thought, I can turn them out, so to speak, and fold them into my own network of people I can sell my horses and slaves to. So I don't think he was too worried about the Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, when he first encountered them in 1847.
I guess he probably knows. He's a smart man. He's enterprising. He knows who the leader of the Mormons is, and he knows it's Brigham Young. I guess he first meets him, I think you say, on Temple Square.
Yeah.
But they had been communicating through letters and messages for a few years. Talk a little bit about when he meets Brigham Young and what they make of each other. They're both leaders. They both thought of themselves as pretty powerful guys.
Yeah, so that first meeting happens in June 1849 in Temple Square, just a few weeks before what would become the first official Pioneer Day celebration on July 24th, 1849. And they're sizing each other up in a lot of ways and testing each other. Mm-hmm. By that time, you know, within 2 years, the community of Latter-day Saints in the Utah Valley has swelled. They haven't yet ventured down into Wakara's home territory, the Timpanogos Utes' home territory, as much in the Utah Valley, but they're looking to expand. And Wakara thinks, I can help them expand. And by helping them expand, they will become, expand my network of trade. And so Wakara tells them about all the great land in San Pitch Valley, where Manti is, Ephraim, those places, and all the great land down along the old Spanish Trail, including Parowan and other locations, really helping direct the Latter-day Saints to where they should expand their settlements, their kingdom, as Brigham Young would put it, in the Great Basin. So he's partnering at that point for his own reasons, towards his own end with the Latter-day Saints. And Brigham Young says, this Indian fellow, as Brigham Young would probably say, Lamanites, based on kind of Book of Mormon language, might help me do a couple of things. Might be a good intermediary for other native peoples, which is essential to, of course, Latter-day Saint theology, but also be kind of a intermediary for trading and make inroads with different native communities that the Mormons wanted to missionize and eventually incorporate into their kingdom.
There's no cleaning up the actual story of Wakara's involvement in slavery. He captured, you say, and enslaved Paiute women and children in southern Utah, would sell them in these slave markets in New Mexico, in the territories there and elsewhere, and write about what became of their lives. They would serve as house servants or field hands, in some cases concubines. I mean, just awful. Mm. It's a terrible part of the story. But a good part of the work that you do in the book is kind of explicating and understanding the native dimension of slavery as compared to settler Indian slavery. Mm. And I want to have you talk about the difference. You say that the native slavery, you don't say it was good, but you say it was about building these kin networks. Mm-hmm. And that was different from settler Indian slavery, which was different. Explain the distinction here that you really work through in the book.
Yeah, it relates to the point about the fish, different kinds of relationships to the land, to the people, to the environment. What I'm working off of some of the great scholars who have really helped bring to the fore and differentiate between chattel slavery, as we kind of understand it, practiced in the South, and this Indian slavery that is as old time immemorial. I mean, native peoples, indigenous people in the Americas had been practicing forms of bondage and slavery long before settlers got here, absolutely. Waqara, as you mentioned, yes, his trading in humans could be as brutal as any chattel slavery practiced in the American South, absolutely, at times. He saw these people as bodies that he could trade away, extract wealth from, extract labor from, extract pleasure from, most likely. But his purpose was different in some ways than the settlers, who, because in all of those motions, when he's trading away and native people, capturing native people and trading away, giving them away, he's trying to build up different networks of trade, but also of kinship. Native Indian slavery, I try to make the point, is about establishing relationships among peoples and to the land. It's highly localized. It's often ceremonial. And so that slaves, though, also can sometimes become kin. Captives can become cousins. In that, sometimes Waqara would capture a Paiute from southern Utah and give it away as a gift, as he did many times to Brigham Young and to the settlers, or trade those enslaved peoples to the settlers, or give a child to a fellow Ute leader like Kanosh, the great another Ute leader.
Yeah.
Ironically, Kanosh's family, Kanosh decided to live close to the Mormons, and that meant, unfortunately, all his children, his biological children, died off by disease. The only child of Kanosh's that survived and lived long enough to have his own children was a man named John Kanosh, who had started life as a child that Waqara gave to Kanosh as a gift. Wow. So Waqara is using slavery, bondage, to build, yes, power, wealth, but to build relationships, fundamentally. Whereas settlers, again, see these bodies as sources to extract wealth, power, to do work for the furtherment, the betterment of the settler project. So they have a different understanding of Indian slavery and how it should function.
And that's, let me read something that you write early on in the book. You write that when they arrived in 1847, the Mormon settlers introduced what they claimed was a new kind of Indian slavery to the Great Basin. And you say that Brigham Young, quoting you here, commanded his followers to buy up the youngest Indian captives and raise them in Mormon homes as their children. Will you explain what's going on? Because you have to sort of get into the way Latter-day Saints and the sort of the doctrine and the sort of the story of the Book of Mormon comes into play with the way they were thinking about all of this.
Yes, yeah, so that is such an important point, and Waqara even participates in this directly in many ways. But yes, yeah, so as I mentioned before, the mandate coming from Joseph Smith, his revelations, and also from the Book of Mormon, sets out the people who receive the Book of Mormon in its early 19th century form, right? Retranslated from these sets of ancient buried plates, right, of Amerindian origin, was to bring the Book of Mormon back to native peoples of the Americas, which in the Book of Mormon and early Mormon history are described as Lamanites, from figures in the Book of Mormon. And so really from the beginning of the Mormon period, starting in 1830, the Latter-day Saints are moving in two directions. They're looking for what they initially called Gentile converts, right, which are Anglo-American, Euro-American converts, but they're always on the lookout for Lamanite converts because they believe what they have to do before Christ will return, they have to build up covenants, familial, like in marriage, trade, and political, like building a city, right? A new Jerusalem in the new world, where Lamanites and Gentiles would govern together. Actually, Lamanites in the earliest period would take the lead so that Christ would return. They didn't have much luck between 1830 and 1847. They had a couple of here and there, a couple of converts, and perhaps some near misses. Native people, for various reasons, weren't that interested in the in much of the Mormon gospel. They're not only pushed west by anti-Mormon persecution, they're pulled west, and that's really important. They knew the presence of Native peoples, and hopefully Native peoples who hadn't, they believed, been kind of tainted by anti-Mormon rhetoric, or even tainted by different missionaries telling them different stories. So kind of a fresh set of people to missionize, to harvest, basically.
Wakara is baptized into the LDS faith in, I think if I have this right, the City Creek of Manti, 1850. How do you make sense of that?
Yes, it's a moment, as I said before, that boy, does Brigham Young and Isaac Morley, the founder of Manti, and they're exchanging letters back and forth about this. Boy, are they happy. Finally, we have, you know, the most powerful, I would argue the most powerful man in the Southwest has has joined up with their faith, right? And has willing to, in their mind, from their perspective, throw off his Indian ways, abandon his Indian ways, and become a faithful and devout and devoted to Brigham Young, they hoped, as the prophet and following his orders, new member of the church. And powerfully, one of the settlers who had witnessed this baptism, and we mentioned White and Delightsome before, and you know, some folks think we made too much of the this language of White and Delightsome and the racial components, but boy, it's right there in the archive. One of the settlers says after Wakara is baptized, and he had been described as, and actually the same, I believe the same settler described him as having tawny skin. After he emerged from the waters, he was as the one settler said, he's as white as me, or as white as any settler. So that baptismal water, boy, it's quite powerful in their imagination to remove this darkness, this taint they believe that Native people carried on their skin.
But he was baptized, Wakara, not because he found the gospel of Mormonism to be true. It was an act of diplomacy, it seems. Like, and one of the things you mentioned is that it was only really – he didn't transfer his spiritual commitment then to Mormonism. It just was another way of thinking about a larger sense of spiritual life. Is that a way to explain it?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's completely fair. From Wakara's point of view, he wasn't throwing off, right, abandoning his Native spirituality or his Native religion. He really, as one of my great friends and scholars, Lynn Fisher, has described about Native conversion, really it's an affiliation, not a conversion. And it's additive instead of replacing. So he's saying, sure, I'll join with you in this community. Again, not to say that that community is supreme or recognizing Mormon supremacy at all. That's how the Latter-day Saints hoped he'd see it. But no, he didn't see it as such. He saw it very much as a way to expand, again, the familial, the kin networks that he was so invested in creating. He wasn't, we talked a lot about violence before, right? And Wakara certainly was responsible for violent acts. But his first move was never violence. His was he knew that violence was bad for business and it doesn't serve him well. He was willing to use violence, but he much prefer diplomacy and creating kin networks. And I just want to say one brief thing about that moment. It's really important that one of the great discoveries of the book, and I thank actually faithful members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and others, and Native genealogists who have done this work, that during that period, Wakara was also placing his own children in the homes of the settlers of Manti. It's very clear, genealogy and archival work and even DNA shows that he placed at least two daughters of his own in settler households. Why? Because he knew that if his own children were in these households, they would create a very strong bond of kinship, literal kinship, and they would be more willing to trade, less likely to go to war. But Wakara also expected white children to be given to him. And there is a couple of scenes where actually Isaac Morley, he asked Isaac Morley, for a white child. Now, that white child was given to Wakara briefly, but according to family history, it was eventually returned. But my point here is, again, when you talk about Indian slavery, native practices of Indian slavery, it's always about creating kin networks. And that, I think, is one of the most powerful discoveries, because we didn't know the actual origins of these children, Indian daughters, as the Manti settlers described them. And so that's quite a revelation. And that means there are lots of folks in the Utah Valley and up in San Pete and other places throughout Utah and throughout the Mormon diaspora who don't know that they are direct descendants of Wakara.
Max Perry Mueller. He's an associate professor in the Department of Classics and Religious Studies at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. We're talking about his book, Wakara's America, The Life and Legacy of a Native Founder of the American West. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Sustain us at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to a conversation with the historian Max Perry Mueller. We're talking about his new book, Wakara's America. Let's talk about what happens to Wakara. He dies, Wakara. He dies in January of 1855. Some belief that he may have been poisoned. It doesn't sound like you think that. What do we know about what happens to Wakara?
Yeah, in the winter of 1854, he goes south to his winter camp along the old Spanish trail south of Parowan with his lodges, and he's trading with the Diné Navajo people and trading with the settlers there. But he moves north fairly abruptly and earlier than he usually would, moving past Parowan and returning home towards Timpanogos Lake. He was actually born at Spanish Fork, but, you know, turning home. He's motivated for some reason to move north quite quickly. And he, along the trail, is getting sicker and sicker. But he reaches space around Fillmore, and I want to be very careful because of the sensitivity of the burial site here.
Yeah.
But let's just say around the area around Fillmore there. And yes, he has one more encounter with a man named John Lewis, who had been deputized as kind of Brigham Young's point person to deal with Wakara during the season. And he receives another peace letter from Brigham Young. These letters were very important to Wakara. He used them to, even though he wasn't lettered, he wasn't literate, he would show these letters throughout the valley as he traded, as kind of traveling papers to show that he was in good standing with the settlers. And so he's given another letter and said, but he didn't have time, he didn't feel well enough to read the letter. And so he went back to his lodges and died the next day on January 29th, 1855. Now, some people believe then and still now that poison was the cause. More like it's hard to say. So more likely, or just as likely, he died of a communicable disease. And then he's buried. He has horses killed. He has enslaved people killed. He has women killed to accompany him to the land.
And we're not going to just zoom past that fact, by the way. You don't do that in the book, but it's really important to say.
Yes,
enslaved people killed and included in the tomb. And one really gruesome fact: a live Paiute boy, an enslaved boy, is buried alive right outside of the tomb or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, help us understand or make sense of that.
Yes, various reports say he was buried up to his neck to kind of scare away scavenging animals, and that the boy, you know, would be feasted on at various points, his body, while he was kind of overseeing Wakara's passage. Yes, it's quite gruesome. It's the folks in the 1870s who would come and later study, quote-unquote study, the kind of funerary practices of Indian people around Americas would see that this is a degree of difference, but not of but necessarily of kind, of different kind of burial sites. So Utes, Paiutes, Shoshone people practice these kind of burials. It's quite gruesome, but it's also an act of preservation. He, in that moment, is trying to preserve his America. So he's trying, in this burial site, trying to preserve in the land the America, both native and settler, that he helped create. And unfortunately, because of grave robbing that happened not once, not twice, but several times over the next century and a half, that space was not preserved. And that is a key part of the story that I tell.
Let me just say, since we don't have time to really dig into the details, just the story about what grave robbers think is Wakara's skull, the story of these skulls that were taken, robbed from graves, is an interesting kind of terrible part of the story. And again, we'll leave readers to find that in the book. Let me ask you finally, I guess, to something you've said, Wakara still remains.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a reference to the idea of Native people who say, we are our ancestors and we're still here. We didn't go anywhere. We talk a little bit about what that means when you say Wakara still remains, because it's not just about the fact that his descendants are still around, as you write about, but it's also about his influence on this place, on this, you know, I'm looking out over the Salt Lake Valley and just this place. Say something about that finally, if you would.
Yes. So, you know, Wakara helped build, really establish the American West as we know it, especially in Utah, but not just in Utah. In California and New Mexico, his influence can be seen if one knows where to look. And so that is one part of it. He really helped build what becomes the American West. But also, we talked a little bit about the fish before. You know, it's a story of return, and that's really important. It's happening down in Utah Lake, Timpanogos Lake, where the June sucker is returning through a very careful and decades-long restoration project that, instead of focusing on what is good for humans, as you know, I'm sure some folks know about the big fight over the island proposal in around Utah Lake. But instead of focusing on what's good, supposedly good for humans, if you focus on what's good for an animal, especially an indicator species like the June sucker, boy, it can begin to restore, not all the way back to pre-settler time, but begin to heal the lake. The June sucker is beginning in fits and starts to spawn in the Provo River, as the Provo restoration project has occurred. So that's one part of it. His horses still remain in the deserts of Utah, between boundary between Utah and Nevada. Some of the horses that he stole, which escaped along that old Spanish trail, some of them made their way north and have lived for now a century and a half reproducing on what is now BLM land. It's called the Sulfur Herd of Horses, direct descendants of the horses that Wakara stole. And really also the stories remain. I think that's really important. Not only his descendants, but it's also a return, as I'm hoping that I bring into being through my partnerships with his descendants, returning the stories to the Wakara's people, but also the descendants of settlers, to show that we all can have played a role in Wakara's story. And we can have a more positive and I think healthier, fruitful contribution to that story going forward. So that's what I mean by remains. Retelling these stories, recentering these stories about his fish, his horses, his slaves, the wars he participated in, yes, even the skulls that were taken from the gravesite, can help us recognize the truth that is always there, that Native people, and in particular Wakeras, Utes, are still here.
Max Paramuller, thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug. This has been such a pleasure.
Max Paramuller, he's an associate professor in the Department of Classics and Religious Studies at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. His book is called Wakeras America, The Life and Legacy of a Native Founder of the American West. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on YouTube at KUER90.1 and Instagram at Radio West. You can email us at radiowest@KUER.org. Aidan Oneida is our social media intern, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.